Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, that's right. I really do think that's going to happen. Again, the level of slaughter that we had even before we sort of got into springtime was very noticeable. Of course, we carried over a lot of drought from last year, so producers looking at their situation, I think we're going ahead. And then they were taking advantage of the fact that the cull-cow market until very recently was exceptionally strong. So they went ahead and moved some of those cows, and some of them were going to move anyway. And I think that's sort of the message here.
Dr. Darrell Peel is Oklahoma State livestock economist on a shrinking herd.
But again, the conditions that we see around the country now would suggest that we're not done with that. We're going to continue to see fairly strong cow movement. And I think the result of that is that we will see a significant decrease in the cow herd inventory come January 1 when we take another look at those numbers.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, one of the things we voted on after the Tea Party swept a lot of us into office was a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution.
Rand Paul is a senator from Kentucky talking about his six-penny plan Wednesday on Fox Business.
Every Republican voted for it. No Democrats did, and it failed. But in the context or in the text of the balanced budget amendment, it says you should balance in 5 years. But then, as you know, many Republicans, when we were in charge, put forward budgets that never balanced or they pretended balanced in 10 years. I stick with the 5 years. So I've been doing this for several years now. And when I started doing it, you could freeze spending and it would balance in 5 years. But then spending got worse, and then we called it the penny plan. Cut 1% and it balances in 5 years. But now you have to cut 6%. But is it doable? Absolutely, without question, it's doable. I can rattle off the top of my head dozens and dozens of wasteful projects that the American public would be horrified to know about. And I'll give you just one example. $750,000 spent to study Japanese quail to see if they're more sexually promiscuous on cocaine. It goes on and on. $2 million spent to study if someone sneezes on your food in front of you, whether you will take or pass that food up. A couple $1 million spent if you take selfies of yourself while smiling and look at those selfies later on in the day if that makes you feel happy. This is riddled throughout our government, and it gets worse every year. And just 2 months ago, a Republican, sort of half of the Republicans with the Democrats, voted to increase the National Science Foundation, which funds a lot of these projects, by 70%. It's got to stop. But both parties are guilty, and we got to quit spending the money.
But don't think he's pointing fingers at the other guys. He says it's actually both parties.
So there's 100 senators. 50 of them are Democrats. None of them support a balanced budget or support cutting any spending or care about the debt. There are 50 Republicans. They all say they care about the debt. But about half or a little bit less than half of the Republicans will vote for a budget that balances in 5 years. And realize my budget doesn't specify where you cut the money. It just says you have to cut X to get to balance in 5 years. So they could actually choose how they want to create the budget. What would happen is the committees would do it. But over half of Republicans will vote against this because they're really not as conservative as they tell their folks when they go home.
Of course, one of the major challenges right now, in addition to the debt, inflation.
You have to understand what causes inflation if you want to fix it. Inflation is caused by deficit spending, and then the Federal Reserve prints up the money to buy our debt. When they do, it expands the money supply. The M2 has gone up at an annualized rate of 15% over the last 3 years. All that new money floods into the system and bids prices up. So a portion of inflation and gas prices going up is without question inflation caused by buying the debt. Now, there's another portion of this. Prices are caused by supply and demand. If you restrict the supply, the price will go up. So what has the Biden administration done? They've quit drilling for oil. They've quit allowing pipelines for oil. And they have said to the people who might build a refinery, we're going to have no gasoline-powered cars in 8 years. So everything they've done is to drive the price up. The war is a component. Speculation on the war is a component. But the primary component is broad-based inflation that's caused by deficit spending. And what does the Biden administration want to do? They want more deficit spending, so they haven't learned their lesson.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
My name is Andy Mueller. I'm the general manager of the Colorado River Water Conservation District.
Testifying recently before the Senate Ag Committee.
As a regional government, we lead in the conservation, development, and protection of the headwaters of the Colorado River in a 15-county area in western Colorado. The precipitation in our district alone provides 65% of the Colorado River's annual average flow. We are at the headwaters of a river system that supports 40 million people, 5 million irrigated acres of agriculture, two countries, 30 sovereign tribal nations, and seven states and 11 national parks. We are the first link in an immense chain vital to the health and future of the single most important natural resource in the American Southwest. The Colorado River is aptly referred to as the hardest working river in America. Maybe the folks from Arkansas would disagree with us, but even in wet years, the river no longer reaches its natural mouth of the Sea of Cortez, and claims to water exceed its annual average flow every year. The massive system of federal reservoirs on the Colorado River was designed and built to accommodate the known natural variability in the river system and worked extremely well for over 50 years. However, the longest and most severe drought on record that once highly functioning federal system is dangerously depleted, with only 34% of system storage remaining, forcing the Department of Interior and the basin states last year and this year to resort to emergency actions to keep the system from collapse. Over the last 22 years, the flows of the Colorado River have been 20% below average, and sound science tells us we should anticipate and plan for significant reduction in flow in the future. The climate we have experienced in the last 20 years, as Senator Bennett alluded to, has been hotter and drier than any period in the last 1,200 years. There is a direct causal relationship between rising temperatures and the volume of water flowing in the Colorado River and its tributaries. Western Colorado, the most significant regional source of water in the Colorado River, is an epicenter for significantly above average rise in temperatures. Most of our 15 counties have experienced a more than 4-degree Fahrenheit rise in temperatures since 1895, with greatly accelerating temperatures over the last decade, a very concerning trend for those of us in the basin. For every 1-degree Fahrenheit rise in average temperature, we see streamflow reductions between 3 and 9%. None have felt these climate impacts more than our family-owned farms and ranches in our Colorado River District. The plentiful water resources of the past are no longer physically or legally available for many of our ag producers. Families who have been involved in ranching for multiple generations are being forced to sell their cattle and confront tremendously uncertain futures. This drought is threatening our local, regional, and national food supply. We cannot, nor will we, throw up our hands and surrender the thriving American Southwest to the forces of climate change. Citizens, communities, and governments throughout the Southwest are developing strategies, but as in the past, when our nation has been confronted by existential threats, we need the federal government to be an integral partner in our efforts. We must recognize that there is no single solution which will allow us to escape this rapidly changing climate. It is a multifaceted effort. I want to touch on a few concrete examples which are worthy of your consideration. We're only beginning to see this climate crisis in the American West. We cannot afford to remain idle as rivers and reservoirs dry and families shutter their business. Wishing for snow and rain is no longer an adequate plan at any level of decision making. If our communities are going to survive in Colorado and downstream, decisive action at the federal level is needed to help us adapt to this hotter and drier future.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
If you look at what the futures market has done, feeder cattle futures have rebounded pretty significantly in the last couple of weeks, and I think that's helping these markets.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Daryl Peel.
Now, it depends a little bit on what weight you look at, of course. Feeder cattle markets include a wide range of different cattle, really, from lightweight calves and stocker cattle to the bigger feeder cattle. And, you know, they both slipped down from the spring highs, but normally at this time of the year, we see these bigger feeder cattle actually move higher seasonally, while the calves typically move a little bit lower into the summer. And so, you know, we've got kind of different directions going on here. The calves have actually dropped the most, the lightweight, you know, the really lightweight end of things over the last 6 weeks or so. And I think that's largely a reflection of the fact that grazing conditions are not good and there just haven't been a lot of prospects for summer grazing for these stocker calves.
Peel also looks at boxed beef.
The boxed beef market is trying to stabilize and actually pull up a little bit. It's been, you know, kind of averaging steady over the last several weeks, had drifted a little bit lower. And again, it did that a little counter-seasonally. We normally see boxed beef move a little higher in May ahead of Memorial Day and the beginning of grilling season. We didn't see that as much this year, but now it looks like maybe that market is trying to pick up just a little bit. So, again, we're watching that very carefully to try to get a bead on where this demand picture is headed for the rest of the summer here.
Now, it's been interesting to dig into the, no pun intended, ground beef market.
If you look over the last several months, really back to about this time last year, we saw beef markets at the wholesale level in particular across the board for all of the cuts as well as for ground beef. If you put together kind of a ground beef series that represents kind of a generalized, there's lots of ways to make ground beef, obviously, but if you look at kind of a generalized ground beef price series, it moved sharply higher about a year ago and stayed high through the rest of the year and has stayed high so far this year. And that's been kind of the story. We didn't see that May increase seasonally, but we were already at a very strong level, and we just really haven't seen that ground beef market falter at all. Now, some of the other beef cuts, which were also high last year, they moved up, they carried through the end of the year, have actually adjusted down significantly from the beginning of the year to this point in time. And so, the ground beef market continues very strong at this point.
What's interesting, when we look at ground beef, prices may be heading higher, Peel says, on the increase in demand.
I think we'll continue to see this strong market. You know, one of the things we've been watching is evidence of what we typically talk about when prices get high and in an inflationary environment, we talk about consumers maybe trading down in their beef purchases. So they're still buying beef, but maybe they're trading out some of the higher-end products for some lower value products, and ground beef usually is one of the places they would turn to. The ground beef market has continued strong, and I don't think the strength that we see today is a result, really, of significant amounts of trading down at this point. I think that market has just been very strong, and it's really got two sides to it. One of them is this time of the year with grilling season, the retail part of the ground beef market is very strong. Consumers taking a lot of burgers home to cook on the grill or on their weekend outings. But we also have, of course, the underlying food service demand, particularly the fast food restaurants. And that has been very strong for about the last year.
Oklahoma State University Cooperative Extension Livestock Economist, Dr. Daryl Peel. And this is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Welcome to World Pork Expo.
Yep, for the first time in 2 years, World Pork Expo is up and going. Terry Walters, new president of NPPC.
We're happy to be back on the fairgrounds here at Iowa State to bring the industry together, celebrate our successes, and share our experiences and connect with fellow producers throughout the country. My fellow officers, Scott and Lori, and I agree, this is a great event We're excited to see so many familiar faces come together and network throughout our industry and help advance despite the many challenges that we have faced over the last 2 years.
But he admits it's time for the National Pork Producers Council to make some changes.
Today we face complex challenges in trade, regulation, labor, foreign animal disease, environmental stewardship, and production mandates. We're faced with unprecedented pressure that's been brought forward by a wide range of individuals that are unfamiliar with progress in modern agriculture and the requirements that it takes to support a food system to support the world. These complex challenges require deliberate, strategic solutions. Last year, NPPC's delegates approved a strategic plan that outlined the priorities and the challenges for our industry. The producer-led task force recognized the additional resources that would be required to meet these challenges. That is why in March at the Pork Industry Forum, NPPC's delegates approved a rate change for our strategic investment program. which will dedicate the resources to NPPC's advocacy efforts, tackling modern issues with modern strategies as part of the pathway to change.
And those changes start with funding and leadership.
A new voluntary funding will allow us to commit programming priorities more deeply, such as keeping markets open, having investors represented in key events, defending science and technology, and more effectively communicating with internal and external audiences. Bold moves take effective leaders to recognize both the importance and the difficulty of implementing change like this. As the president of this incredible organization, I believe Brian Humphries, as the CEO, has the vision and the strategic plan and the focus to lead us and help the NPPC industry and stakeholders to advance and address these changes.
And speaking of the leadership, the new CEO of the National Pork Producers Council is Brian Humphries.
Our history is not only one of dates, it is of people and their actions. Our history as an industry is really of those leaders who shared a common vision on what we could do together and then had the dedication to a greater purpose to see it through. It is that history that laid the groundwork for the groundbreaking successes that NPPC will highlight throughout this week. Today is a continuation of that groundwork, built upon the work of NPPC's long-range strategic plan and the decisions of the Pork Industry Forum delegates. And as Terry mentioned, we are building upon this great momentum.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
My name is Earl Lewis. I'm the chief engineer of the Kansas Department of Agriculture's Division of Water Resources and a member of the Western States Water Council, who I appear on behalf of today.
Lewis testifying recently before the Senate Ag Committee.
The Western States Water Council is a member organization representing the 18 Western states, and members are appointed by and advise each of the governors. As each of the people that have talked before me have mentioned, the situation in the West is dire. We've heard about the Colorado River Basin, the 40 million people and 5 million acres that are challenged with low water supply. The situation in the Great Plains is similar in the fact that over time we are receiving less precipitation and are challenged by drought. Each year when we have less precipitation, that means that our farmers are pumping more water, exacerbating the declines of the Ogallala Aquifer. This is a vital resource for our region, and if we don't act, we'll end up with a situation with that resource going away, as well as the agricultural production that's associated with that irrigation. There are three roles that I believe the federal government plays when it comes to drought. First, operation of federal infrastructure, particularly with Bureau of Reclamation and Corps of Engineers. Second, collection, analysis, and distribution of data to all levels of government and individual producers. And third, cost-share programs to producers and communities that help to mitigate drought and its effects. The collection, analysis, and open sharing of reliable data is important for water availability for all levels of government. I'd like to touch on a few of those that deal with the federal government. The National Integrated Drought Information System, or NIDIS, is a multi-agency partnership that coordinates drought monitoring, planning, and forecasting, including the drought monitor, which we talked about here today. The Western States Water Council supports NIDIS and co-chairs its executive council with USDA and NOAA. Senator Thune has been a champion of NIDIS and drought monitoring improvements, and we thank him for his past support. In much of the West, winter snowpack and spring runoff dominate stream flow and water supply. USDA's Snow Survey and Water Supply Forecasting Program and Snowtell within NRCS is critical for water users, managers, and planners. Program funding has been flat at about $9 million per year over the last two decades. While equipment, staffing, and other costs have increased, challenging the program to meet staffing levels and to maintain an adequate network. An anticipated 50% increase in the President's 23 budget has not been realized, although we would encourage your consideration of this request. The Western States Water Council also supports robust programmatic funding for improved seasonal to subseasonal precipitation forecasting, often known as S2S. it is critical to improve lead time for water supply planning, as well as reservoir and agricultural operations. Pilot programs have been proposed to improve NOAA's 90-day precipitation forecast, but funding has been inadequate to date. Finally, USDA conservation assistance programs help agriculture industry thrive in good times and survive in hard times. The Council supports collaborative, targeted, and voluntary programs promoting conservation practices and groundwater recharge to preserve long-term ground and surface water resources. Programs such as EQIP, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, and Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program are all programs which implement best management practices on the ground to lessen the need for water and help mitigate drought. Likewise, the USDA's Rural Development Agency helps rural communities plan and implement projects to have a reliable water supply. Planning for and limiting the impact of drought will take all levels of government working together, which is why I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Today, I am excited to share with you the culmination of our strategic planning process and repositioning effort that will transform the future of our organization to better serve our pork producers.
Brian Humphreys is CEO, National Pork Producers Council.
Our new logo is symbolic of where we are heading as an organization as we take important steps today to achieve groundbreaking successes tomorrow. This symbol is a commitment. This transformation and energized focus will help propel the industry forward in an aligned, energized, and strategically driven for producers under new leadership, guided by long-range strategic plan, and fueled by new funding support.
Speaking at a press conference opening up World Pork Expo, talked about the upcoming Farm Bill.
MPPC is looking to show up differently, to maximize the impact that we have and expand the groundbreaking work we seek to accomplish. This has never been more important, because the challenges that our producers face continue to be more and more complex and dynamic. As we work to identify solutions that are constantly evolving, this means we have to be more collaborative across the pork industry, the agricultural sector, and the entire food chain. The challenges that we face cannot be tackled alone, and collaboration will be imperative to influencing change on critical issues.
Could one of those partners be the cotton industry? Sean Wade is with Plains Cotton Growers.
Yeah, the 2018 Farm Bill from a cotton perspective has been, a very good bill. Primarily just from the standpoint that it's the first Farm Bill, a full Farm Bill where, cotton has been actually back in as a part of a covered commodity list within that Farm Bill program set. As you remember, back in the 2014 Farm Bill, cotton was removed as a covered commodity, and then we were able to see cotton seed actually put back in as a covered commodity just prior to the end of that bill and just in advance of the 2018 Farm Bill consideration. So from a cotton perspective, the 2018 bill has been a good one. The programs have worked the way they were designed, and growers, I think, by and large, are happy with most of those components. But as you say, it's time to kind of look ahead to the next Farm Bill. And, commodity groups like Plains Cotton Growers, the Southwest Council of Agribusiness, the corn producers, the sorghum producers, the wheat producers, everybody is really beginning to kind of start those internal conversations about, what this next Farm Bill needs to look at as we kind of contemplate the input situation, the cost of inputs that we've seen, rapidly increasing over the last few months. As we consider, what may or may not happen with prices, will they stay at these levels? Are they projected to fall? And what could that mean for producers 2 or 3 years down the road? A catastrophic price decline without much relief on the input cost side is going to be a very hard situation for most growers in the country to deal with. So, yeah, there's a lot of discussions that are being had, of course, we're seeing that happen in Congress as well with, this week, a few hearings already starting on the House Agriculture Committee side, talking about the Farm Bill and what it's doing and how it's working and trying to get some input from groups. And that will just pick up as we move through the rest of this season and the rest of this calendar year and really kind of get ramped up for consideration of the Farm Bill next year.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We typically think of BRD as a post-weaning feedlot stalker cow thing, but this is a oncoming, more and more often disease outbreak that we're seeing in calves before weaning when they're out on pasture.
K-State veterinarian Greg Hanselcheck.
For those calves that have experienced this disease but actually don't succumb to it, there's some estimates that their average daily gain or their weaning weights are 17 to 35 pounds lighter. It's considered to be the number one reason why calves die from 3 weeks of age until weaning in the United States. So it's a big deal. There's some really good surveys out there that are nationwide cow-calf surveys, and they show that 18 to 20% of all the cow-calf operations say that they do experience some type of summer pneumonia. We don't hear that much about it, but we're beginning to believe it's a big deal, and we need to start talking about it more.